This interview with Professor Carl Murray from Queen Mary University of London is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, visit jodcast.net.
So thank you very much indeed for joining us today and having a chat about your work with Cassini. So tell us a little bit about the Cassini mission.
Oh, gosh. It was started back in 1990. It was first proposed. And it's a joint mission between NASA, ESA, and the Italian Space Agency. And the idea is to send two spacecraft to Saturn. The Huygens probe, which is going to be built by the European Space Agency, attached to the Cassini probe, which would be built by NASA. It was launched just over 10 years ago, in October 1997. It took 7 years to get to Saturn. And about 6 months after it was in orbit, the Huygens probe was released, parachuted through the atmosphere of Titan and landed safely on the surface of Titan, sending back data. And the Cassini mission, which is the Saturn orbiter, has continued in orbit ever since and has another 7 months, 8 months of its nominal mission to go.
Mm. It's a remarkably long-lived mission, isn't it? I mean,
you need to be a remarkably long-lived scientist to participate in it.
It's a good point, though, isn't it? Because a lot of these people start their careers planning and designing a mission which isn't going to fly for 20 years, even if it gets funded. So,
exactly. I mean, you know, even colleagues, UK colleagues, have actually died, and you know, since they were selected, it's one of the amazing things about the mission is that there are so many people involved in it. And you're seeing young scientists come through who were PhD students or even maybe still at high school when the mission started and are now sort of taking faculty positions and doing Cassini research. And I think that will be the legacy of the mission will be for the next generation to take up where we left off, carrying on the research.
What happens when you've done all the background work, you've designed, you've built the experiment, you've designed and built the equipment that's going to be launched, in this case the Cassini and Huygens probe. It launches and then you look at your watch and think, oh, 7 years to go, time for a cup of tea. What do you do? What do you do for 7 years?
Well, we actually, at the time the spacecraft was launched, we still did not have in place a plan as to exactly the nature of the orbital tour, because there's so many options we could take, you know. We knew we would have to fly by Titan because although it's not only an interesting target, it's also the means by which we change the orbit of the spacecraft. Mm. But it's how we change the orbit of the spacecraft. So what we had within the mission was a diversity of views. So if you're, for example, a satellites person, you want to have lots of satellite flybys. If you're a rings person, you don't want to be in the equatorial plane. You want to be out of the equatorial plane so you can see the rings. Mm. On the other hand, if you're an atmospheres person, you'd like to be in the equatorial plane so the rings don't get in the way of the planet. And it's been a continual process reconciling that and then planning the tour in general in terms of when we're up and when we're down from the ring plane and then in absolute specific detail down to the last second of what instrument's going to be prime and what other instrument's riding along with it and so on. And that's for, you know, every second of a four-year mission. And that took some time. So by the time we got there, that was more or less in place. But it's a continual process of updating and tweaking.
So that's what you spend the time, the flight time between launch and arrival at Saturn, is fine-tuning the aspects of the tour.
In a way, we had like a dry run at Jupiter. We got the opportunity to do science at Jupiter, and we got some interesting observations, the Galileo satellites of Jupiter's atmosphere itself. And it was good for my colleagues who were involved in Galileo, which, of course, had that trouble with its high-gain antenna not opening properly. And they were in orbit around Jupiter but couldn't do the science that they wanted to do. So in a way, we kind of made up for that and did a really good science flyby of the Jupiter system with Cassini.
What's your job with the Cassini mission? What did you do?
Well, I'm a member of the Cassini imaging team. I'm one of three Europeans involved in the team. And it's what's called a facility instrument in that the project, in this case JPL, built the cameras for us. And what we had to do was design the operation of the cameras. And my particular interest is in rings, so Saturn's a good place to go, and dynamics and the interaction between rings and small satellites. And that's kept me occupied for quite a while.
Because this is a spectacular part of Saturn, obviously, is the ring system. And as you say, it's the place to go if you're interested in the dynamics and the structure of Saturn's rings. What do we understand about Saturn's rings at the moment?
we knew before we got there that, I mean, this goes back to the work of James Clerk Maxwell. Everybody maybe has heard of Maxwell's equations, electromagnetic theory and so on. But he also, in his youth, produced a lovely essay on the nature of Saturn's rings. And he was able to prove mathematically that the rings couldn't be solid. They had to be composed of individual particles, like mini satellites. So the rings are composed, we know, even though we've never actually seen a ring particle, we know that they're composed of individual particles. And typical sizes are sort of centimetre, but you can have bigger, you've got sort of house-sized objects and a few mountains here and there, but mostly sort of centimetre size. And we know the rings have structure. They're sort of broadly divided into the A, B, C and D rings, which are the main ring system, and there are a few other rings outside that. And we know that there are differences between those broad divisions of rings. But we didn't know much more about the whole system until Cassini got there. We had a few hints from Voyager. And this is the difference between Cassini and Voyager. Voyager was a flyby mission. So we had two flybys of Saturn, 1980 and 1981. And you get, you know, a week or two flyby with lots of different targets. And you get a chance to look at the rings. And the discovery from Voyager was that the rings appeared to have an incredible amount of detailed structure. And that, of course, we could see in great detail with Cassini. And we can see it again and again because we're in orbit. And again, the beauty of this mission is we can see things change.
Right.
We can go back and look at something again. You could never do that with Voyager. Maybe with Voyager 1, you'd see something and then program Voyager 2 to have another look. And that actually happened with one of the rings, the F ring, which is one of my particular interests. And then something happened to Voyager 2 while it was in the middle of all its activity. The scan platform actually sort of froze and got jammed, possibly due to with crossing the ring plane, possibly due to so much activity. So we lost out when that happened with Voyager 2. And so we've been waiting to look at the F-ring again until we got there with Cassini, which is tantalising glimpses from Voyager.
You say that you know that Saturn's rings have a remarkable amount of structure. That's one of the results from the first Voyager mission going past it. What do you mean by extra structure? Well, it's very, very structured.
Well, we used to think Saturn's rings were, like, I would say, broad and bland. You know, they used this the A, B, C, and this very faint D ring. But with Voyager, we saw that they all the individual rings just broke up into thousands upon thousands of little ringlets, except they're not really separate rings. What you're looking at is a sort of like a continuum, and that the rings are have a very specific structure. It's certainly in the case of the A ring that's actually caused by the small moons that are orbiting just outside. And they create a sort of gravitational response in the rings at certain locations. And so a lot of the structure is actually what are called, it's actually a theory that comes from galactic dynamics, or bending waves, or spiral density waves and bending waves. And we see these in Saturn's rings because, in a sense, Saturn's rings are like a, if you like a miniature solar system, or if you like a sort of miniature galaxy with a sort of central object and lots of small objects moving around. So the processes are kind of similar.
What's the nomenclature? What's the naming convention? You've got the A, B. These are all very exotic names.
It's got out of hand now because the going outwards from Saturn, it's D, C, B, A, F, G, and E. And then, so it was, I guess, was in order of discovery. Yes, so it was A to C, then D was discovered as a very faint ring interior to C. Then the E ring was discovered, and that's turned out to be one of the most fascinating. But that was a very diffuse ring outside the main ring system, and the F and G are narrow rings just outside the main ring system, but interior to the E ring. So it's complicated.
Very complicated. Why so complicated? Why are there so many different rings? Why is there so much structure in Saturn's ring system?
That's a good question. The A ring we think we know, that the fine detail we think we know are due to these small moons. The B ring is still kind of a mystery because you say, okay, there's structure there. It looks like the structure in the A ring. But on the other hand, the small moons don't have these gravitational effects in the B ring at these what are called resonant locations. So we don't really know what's going on in the B ring, and various sort of fluid dynamical models have been proposed to try and understand that. The C ring, again, you start to see some of the structure. The C ring and the A ring are kind of similar in that respect. And the D ring is showing some bizarre things that are we think are due to impacts relatively recent impacts. Mm-hmm. And there are very few actual gaps in the rings. You may be talking about a dozen real gaps. But even that's a misnomer, because actually in the gaps we find small rings right in the middle of the gap.
Really?
And it was thought, maybe Cassini hasn't had enough time to do this yet, but it was thought that these gaps would, these rings in these gaps would have little small satellites. And we've looked and we can't find them, with two exceptions. One is the Encke gap in the A ring. And we knew from even before Cassini that there was a moon in there, and that was discovered in Voyager observations, 10 years actually after the Voyager observations were taken. Mm. It was in the record. Wow. And it was found. And then one that Cassini has found is a moon, Daphnis, that's orbiting in the Keeler gap, which is right near the very edge of the A ring. And so we believe these two little moons have actually created the gaps for themselves. Mm. And certainly in the case of Pan in the Encke gap, there's a ring associated with it. And various other features in the Encke gap. Nothing that we can really see in the Keeler gap associated with Daphnis. But small moons kind of create their own little environment and can have rings associated with them.
Right. So do these moons clear out the space of the rings? Or
I described it once like a sort of juggernaut on a motorway. If the juggernaut comes up the middle end of the motorway, you get out of the way, and it kind of scatters cars left and right, or at least you want to get out of the way. And it literally is like that. There's a gravitational sort of clearing zone on either side, really a region which is chaotic, and the orbits no longer become nicely streamlined, and you get collisions between them, and so a region tends to get cleared, and the bigger the moon, the bigger the gap that would be cleared.
What about these gaps which don't seem to have a moon associated with them?
That's still a mystery. And the rings that even are in these gaps are mysterious as well, in that they're eccentric. And you think, okay, well, I mean, what's wrong with that? Most orbits and of things are eccentric.
They're not perfectly circular?
They're not perfectly circular. So, but the peculiar thing about that is, and we see this elsewhere in the solar system, the rings of Uranus is another example, that these eccentric rings have radial width, okay, so they may be only a few kilometres across. And the rate at which an eccentric ring would not just remain sort of stationary in space, it would actually rotate, because the planet it's orbiting isn't perfectly spherical. Mm-hmm. And so you get this precessional effect, it's called. But the inside of the ring should precess faster than the outside. But it doesn't. It precesses as if it was one ring right in the middle. And so there's no differential precession that we can detect. And we know this from Uranus rings, and now we see it at Saturn as well. And it's kind of still a mystery. The obvious explanation is itself gravity. It's actually the mass exterior to the inner ring, inner part of the ring, is kind of pulling it back, and the mass interior to the external part of the ring is pulling it forward, so that everything kind of rotates at the same rate. And that would explain some things, but It does appear that you have to have exactly the right distribution of mass for that to work. It's not like a random thing. So where do these rings come from? You know, was there a moon there once? And if so, what happened to it? And if it's broken up, perhaps it produces this eccentric ring, which somehow arranges itself that it precesses uniformly. There's lots of little problems like that.
I suppose, though, if you think of the Saturn's ring system as being a whole bunch of particles which are just testing out the local environment, if you like, around Saturn, including the gravity and the effects of the moons, then perhaps it's quite reasonable to think that, well, some of the moons will clear out gaps, and some particles in the rings will just go, well, if you can't handle being a precessing ring which precesses in this particular way, then, you know, you get ejected or moved to a point where you can. Does that seem fair enough?
That's true. It's kind of like a natural selection, I think. Yeah, that's actually the case. And this is the thing that we have with Cassini. I mean, we've explained some of the things the Voyager saw, but then we're seeing other things that we'd never seen before, and we're trying to rack our brains to figure out what on earth is going on. And we figure at the back of it all, it's just like little Newtonian gravity. And we're just trying to figure out what the boundary conditions are that are applied at Saturn for these kind of strange things to work.
How much better are the images on Cassini as opposed to the Voyagers?
Okay, well, better in different senses. Voyager had first of all, didn't have CCD technology, so the Voyager images were, okay, they came back as digital, but they were essentially analog, a device. But they were 800 by 800, and they were 8-bit images. Cassini images are 1024 by 1024, and we operate a lot of the time in 8-bit, but we can take 12-bit images as well.
When you talk about 8-bit and 12-bit images, okay. You're talking about the range of...
Yeah, it's like a grayscale. So 8-bit images means you've got a grayscale that goes from 0 to 255. So you've got gradations going from sort of white to black of that sort of level. With 12-bit, you're going up to sort of 0 to 4095. So the sort of dynamic range of the images. So if you've got a bright stuff and dark stuff, you can, as long as you set the exposure right, you can get everything in the one image and boost the dark material, sort of dark part of the image on your computer if you want to look at that. So in those sort of raw terms, we got a better camera system, a better CCD system. We've actually, the optics hasn't changed much. In fact, the wide-angle camera, we've got two cameras on Cassini, as Voyager did, but the wide-angle camera in Cassini is actually the same optical assembly that was used in Voyager. It's a spare from Voyager.
So is that right?
So good optics don't change, right? It's what goes at the end of the telescope or the camera that changes. But we've also got a really good color filter set. So, we've got H-alpha filters for people looking for sort of lightning and Saturn's atmosphere. And we've got everything we want to do sort of color. And we've got some near-infrared region that we can look at as well. So it's much better than Voyager, which had a very sort of small filter set. And basically the technology behind it is a lot better.
So these improvements have now started asking more uncomfortable questions about Saturn's ring system.
Yeah, I mean, one of my specialities is the F-ring, which is this... Voyager saw this bizarre twisted ring outside the main ring system, and we just got this little glimpse, and then we got another glimpse with Voyager 2, it was 8 or 9 months later, and it looked completely different. And that was the first problem. Well, is it changing, or are we just looking at a different part of the ring? It was always a mystery, and... As I said, Cassini tends to solve some mysteries and then devises its own ones. And what we've seen with the resolution we've got with and the time to go and look at the F-ring is the most bizarre system. And I've been sort of racking my brains trying to understand it. And we're coming to grips with it. And we're realizing that we'd always assumed that it wasn't just the F-ring. And we knew it had two shepherding moons, Prometheus and Pandora, that orbit either side. Could see those with Voyager. We can even see them from HST and some ground-based instruments. And we know that they gravitationally interact with the F-ring, and we can actually see that effect now, and we can understand that. But we always suspected there was something else going on. And we've seen a few objects, a couple of ones we've catalogued, but it's so difficult because, if I had the spacecraft to myself, of course, we'd be looking at the F-ring all the time, but I'm sharing it as a sort of indicator with others, unfortunately. So we never get to do exactly what we want. So what happens is we get a little glimpse of the F-ring, and we see these little moonlets or objects, let's call them, in the F-ring, and we get a little bit of information about their orbits. But then we don't go back and look at the F-ring. In one case, we hadn't really good observations of the F-ring for about 400 days because we were in the equatorial plane. Then we go back, and then we might see a completely different ring, and we might see other objects, and we don't know whether they're the same objects or not, or these new objects, because the F-ring has an ability, we believe, to sort of like produce. There's some things go on, clumps appear in the F-ring, and we're not quite sure what they are. But we had an amazing observation that came in last December, where we saw what appeared to be some collisional event in the F-ring. And our prime suspect for the object that's responsible is a little guy that we found back in 2004, called S2004S6, that we think is actually every so often goes through a series of encounters with the F-ring, and we're actually looking at the collisions. And so all the structure that we see and the multi-stranded structure of the F-ring could actually be due to, a few of these little guys that are actually colliding with it, and then the F-ring evolving with all the debris that's around it. And so we've got those kind of observations. We're also seeing the effects of small moons. It's wonderful that the debris that's produced by these collisions gives us little tracers, right, as to the location of other moons, because now we can see their gravitational effect on this trace material. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bonus, because we're seeing kind of dynamical phenomena that we kind of should have realized would be there. But we've seen it in the F-ring, and then we can see it in simulations. We say, we know what we're looking at.
This F-ring, though, I've seen images of it. It's remarkable that it is twisted, and twisted in the sense of like a strand of cotton, several strands of cotton all twisted together.
Well, is it?
Well, is it? Okay. Well, what is the twistedness of the F-ring?
When we saw it with Voyager, we developed a theory that it was multi-stranded. It looked like it had parallel strands, okay? And it's like the old thing with the elephant, you know, where you examine, if you're blindfolded and you examine the elephant and you hold on to the trunk or the tail or one of its legs, you're seeing a different thing, but it's just one beast. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a really small view of the F-ring, a narrow view they get with Voyager, you might consider that these strands are parallel. So it's like an eccentric ring. It is precessing uniformly like those other little rings, but it has this multi-stranded structure, okay? But what we saw with Cassini and realized is that these strands are actually, some of them are spirals, right? And if you think about a sort of tightly wound spiral that goes around two or three times, if you look at it, some places you'll see, you know, one, two strands, and other places, you know, maybe more. Mm-hmm. And because the thing evolves and keeps wrapping around, it'll change with time.
So if you looked at the same part, or at least the same direction of the F-ring, you might see the thing become multi-stranded, or appear to be multi-stranded, yeah. And then this multi-strandedness, that's a word, it goes away.
Exactly. And now what we're doing is developing a theory for that can explain it, and ties in. We were lucky that the observations where we saw this collision in December were the start of a whole sequence of stares at the F-ring that lasted right through till May. And we're just preparing the results of those for publication. And so we're seeing some really interesting phenomena. And one of the theories for the spirals was that it was due to a collision, and possibly with this little guy, S2004, S6. And that appears to be the case. And that would produce like what would look like a sort of radial jet, which would then start to shear because of Kepler's third law, because it would move according to where it was relative to Saturn, and the further away it was, the slower it would move. So anything that was radial would shear, and so you can imagine that then starting to form a spiral. Given enough time, that material just spirals out. And of course, it wouldn't just be one jet. There'd be another jet after every time you got a collision. There'd be another jet forming and another jet, and then because of the way S2004 S6 interacts with Saturn and the F-ring. It might suddenly cease because their orbits no longer intersect. And then maybe a few years later, they start intersecting again. And that seems to be the case because the F-ring we saw, and this is the beauty of the mission, of course, the F-ring we saw in 2004 looks like the F-ring we're seeing in 2006, 2007, but not like the F-ring we saw in between. And so it is the most dynamic and obviously violent place to be, because these things are colliding with velocities of, you know, tens of meters per second. So.
What are these objects that are colliding? These are small moonlets.
Well, the assumption is they're moonlets, that they're moons themselves. But originally we thought maybe that, because the F-ring produces so many different things, these could be just dust balls, that you've got some collection of dust that, to all intents and purposes, looks like a moon. And they were sort of hazy-looking, and they did seem to have tails and so on at one stage. So we had no way of knowing whether there was real mass there until these events started happening. And a dust ball can't produce the sort of phenomena that we're seeing in the F-ring. So these are real mass, although you've got to question what the long-term future of this thing is, you know, if it's continually colliding with the F-ring.
These could well be transient events. You may not ever see an F-ring or something that looks like an F-ring again if there weren't additional collisions.
Well, that's right. And you have to say, well, okay, these are probably, and I think this is true, these are probably just the bigger objects that are in the ring. We think there are smaller objects, and we think we can see their gravitational signature as well. So there's a whole spectrum of objects in the F-ring. And then you've got to question the fact, well, you know, why is this ring so unusual? Because all the other rings are so well behaved, and I think it has to be because it's young. We're looking at a ring that has still in its sort of juvenile phase. It's like the Kevin of rings. It's still it's still not doing what it's supposed to do. It's sort of like, you know, sort of a teenager perhaps, and it's still young, so it hasn't really sorted itself out yet, but it's in the process of doing that.
So presumably, well, one possibility is that it will settle down and it will become like a normal ring.
Exactly.
if there is such a thing.
And the beauty of this is, you know, we're seeing processes that we never dreamt we would ever get to see. And the beauty of it is that these processes happen on a much larger scale in the early formation of the solar system or any planetary system. Mm. When you've got a system of protoplanets and the sort of disk out of which they formed, and they're interacting with it. So we're seeing all these processes in orbit around Saturn, but it's just sort of like a miniature version of a forming protoplanetary disk. And so the more we can understand, with Cassini, these processes, the more we can apply them to our own origin of our own solar system and other solar systems.
So there's a direct link between what we're seeing in with the evolution of Saturn's disk system, which is currently going on at the moment. It's only possible with a mission that can give us that time-resolved information, basically. It's not just, whoosh, there goes Voyager past Saturn, and click, click, oh, we're off again. It's actually sitting there watching this occurring in real time, so to speak. Because that's a big question, isn't it, about how did our solar system form? How do you go from the dust, the small particles in the protoplanetary disk, which is similar, I suppose, to the Saturn's ring system, to things like and me.
Yeah, but the beauty of it is it's like a sort of physical experiment. You know, how would you test an hypothesis? You set up an experiment. Well, nature has set up the experiment for us. This is the only disk that we can get to and look at in detail. And everything else we're relying essentially on the electromagnetic radiation from them, the light from other disks, much more violent astrophysical disks. But this is one and okay, it's not a direct analog in the sense that the boundary conditions, the velocities and so on are all different. But it's the same physical laws that are applying, and we can see the same phenomena. I mean, for example, we've seen in the A ring these features called propellers, which tell us that there are these 100-meter moons, and we're not seeing the moons themselves because we don't have the resolution, but we're seeing their gravitational effect on the nearby material, and they produce this slightly offset linear features, but each slightly offset, which is given this propeller thing. And
what do these propellers look like?
Well, they look like sort of just little lines, two lines. They come in pairs with a sort of possible gap between them. But the lines are parallel, but they're not aligned with each other. See what I mean? So there's a slight offset.
Are these lines pointing away from the center of Saturn?
Oh, no, they're pointing in the direction of motion around.
Right, okay.
So this is because you've got an embedded satellite and material on the inside is moving faster. It's catching it up, and then it gets perturbed as it moves past, and some of the material on the outside is moving slower, so it gets encountered by the satellite, the small moon, and so you get, on the inside going ahead, you get perturbed material, and on the outside behind you get perturbed material. So you get this slight offset, and we've seen it operating with Daphnis in the Keeler gap, and how it affects the ring edges on either side. But these are small embedded moons in the A ring, and when I saw these with Cassini, I recognized immediately the phenomenon because I'd seen it in my colleague down the corridor who does planetary formation studies, and he has protoplanets in a disk, and you could see the same phenomenon on an entirely different scale, but exactly the same phenomenon.
So what are the chances, do you think, of actually, learning from Saturn's ring structure, just the mechanism by which we form planets? How would we do it? Would we need to send another mission with even better resolution, or would we need to stay there for 10, 15 years and watch very closely what's going on? What would we need to do?
Well, let's not give up on Cassini first, because we've got till the end of June 2008 for the nominal mission, and then we're hopeful that it's going to be an extended mission for at least 2 years, and maybe even an extended mission beyond that. Okay, and plans are already afoot. ESA's chosen missions for further study, which include a Saturn mission, which have a Titan lander and an Enceladus probe as well, because Enceladus is this bizarre moon that's sort of spewing out ice, which forms the E-ring, this diffuse ring. Yeah. So undoubtedly there will be further missions to the Saturn system. That's definitely going to happen.
What's the limiting factor on Cassini's lifetime?
The real limiting factor is the amount of fuel it's got. Newton's law says it'll just keep going as long as it's in orbit. It doesn't need to keep firing its engines. But we use the fuel to make small course corrections so that we can hit the aim point as we go past Titan exactly, so to get into the right orbit and so on. And when that runs out, that means we can no longer control the spacecraft in terms of orientating the spacecraft and making changing its orbit and so on. We're totally at the mercy of the gravity field of the planet and the moons. So with judicious use of that fuel, we can make this mission last quite a few years yet. But, you know, it also depends on the willpower and the funding of the agencies to say this is a worthwhile mission, and that needs to go ahead. But I'm sure they'll see sense.
So these results about the F-ring are being published soon?
Written as we speak. It sounds strange, but literally my ideas and my colleagues at Queen Mary our ideas about these things change on an almost daily basis, because I mean, imagine it, you're looking at something that nobody's ever seen before in any other context, and you're just racking your brain trying to say what am I looking at, and you know, what tests can I do, like any scientist, what tests can I do to sort of prove my theory is correct. And we're seeing things all the time because we're concentrating on one area to, let's say, look at the jets, and we think we can understand that. But at the same time, if you look at even greater detail, you want to say, where are the small moons? We think we can see that, and we think we know where they are. So it's like, I've described it as like a dark matter problem. We've got a little dark matter problem at Saturn. You know, where are these moons that we know are causing these effects on the F-ring, but where are they? Yeah. So it's a lot to think about, and our ideas are changing, and it's nice to share them with colleagues and at meetings. But it's coming to fruition with the F-ring. I mean, I can see it keeping me occupied until my retirement, a few years away yet. But and that would be a great thing, because I think it's still full of surprises, and it is certainly, as regards the mission, one of the sort of prime goals for ring science anyway. Because it's a ring. Every time you look at it, you're guaranteed to see something of interest. Mm. And you can't say that about many rings.
Well, we wish you all the very best for the research, and we look forward to the conclusions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.